The disease known as the Black Death began somewhere in Asia. Well, we do not know where exactly. Most probably it's in a region of the world we now call Russia. It began on the Asian steppes, a slight variant on previous versions of the same disease that had haunted mankind for centuries. This version of it emerged somewhere between the myriad of villages and tribes on a region of the land history likes to call the Silk Road. When the Mongol Khans had carved their massive empire across Asia, one side effect had been the ability to travel from east to west to trade had grown considerably easier, and humans began to travel along it to make profit. And at this time, and a leisurely place, the disease began to spread. The plague seemed to move cautiously westward and southwards, seeping into the city of Sarai that sat on the banks of the Volga River round about 1345. Sarai was a cosmopolitan place, filled with exotic goods, and was a colourful and noisy city, the capital of the Golden Horde. Here it settled and grew before it seeped southwards, and eventually reached Astrakhan and then down to Azerbaijan. And around now, it reached the Crimea, a region that was the meeting ground for Christian and Muslim traders. Its impact there was terrible, as the Black Death first showed just how ferocious a disease it was going to be. They say 85,000 people in the Crimea died from its dark touch. And in the panic and confusion of the times, the Muslim traders decided that the Christian merchants must somehow be responsible for the appalling mortality. The providence of this claim is dubious, however. The story goes that in panic and fueled by the fury of fearful men, the Muslims launched an attack upon a trading station run by Genoese merchants in a place called Tanna, and that outnumbered by the locals, the Christians had retreated to their larger coastal station at Kaffa on the northern shore of the Black Sea, where the Muslims besieged them. The chances are this entire narrative was a later embellishment. In truth, Kaffa was already a military target for the locals and had been besieged by the Mongols a few years before the plague had ever even reached the region. One of the Khans of the Golden Horde, Khan Janibeg, had tried to take the city by force and expel the Genoese colony on the Black Sea all the way back in 1343, but he'd given up when a relief force from Italy had arrived. Around 1346, he was besieging the town again with a massive army, complemented by a plethora of trebuchets, and was seeking to bombard the Genoese into submission. Suddenly, the plague erupted in his army's ranks, wiping out more men than any battle. The story always goes that in the face of this infection, the Khan decided to call off the whole thing, and in a malicious act of spite, Janibeg decided that the Genoese should also suffer from the plague, and so fired the bodies of plague victims over the walls via his many catapults. This probably never happened. What was more likely is that the army left, the people who were besieged went out to see what they'd left behind, and in the cramped and fetid conditions of the city of Kaffa, besieged and isolated as it has been, and those rat-infested streets, the Black Death found a ready home. And so while the besieging army left, the disease conquered it. The residents could do little to stop it, and those who could took to their ships and fled. Of course, as well as refugees from Kaffa, the disease came with them. We read in the annals of the Byzantine historian Nikephoros Grigorius how the plague travelled west of the Bosphorus. It ravaged Constantinople and then went south and drove more refugees who travelled to the Middle East. But 12 ships sailed from the Crimea and from that terrible death there and eventually reached the central Mediterranean. In early October 1347, 12 Genoese merchant galleys arrived at the port of Messina in Sicily. Messina was an important stop-off on the route to the east, bringing silks and spices from Asia. This time, however, these ships brought no treasures to be sold for profit. Newly arrived from Kaffa, the Messenian officials who boarded these galleys discovered that scarcely anyone was alive on the 12 ships. Those who were displayed a pronounced lethargy and a strange sickness, quote, that seemed to cling to their very bones, unquote. They suffered from black boils and everything that came out of their bodies, their breath and the smell of their sweat smelled awful. The Messenians didn't really hesitate. Within a day or so, the galleys were driven from the port. Plagues like this were not totally unknown. Outbreaks had been seen before, but they'd always been small, isolated, would hit single locations like Rome in 1230 or Florence in 1244. But this was not like those versions. And while those ships had only stayed in Messina for at most a few days, it was enough. The Black Death made landfall in Europe and began its terrible journey to London. Hi there, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the history of the city in one massively long tale. We have reached the arrival of the Black Death, the disease that would for hundreds of years haunt our city. No other infection was to have such an impact upon London, and its first arrival was apocalyptical. So much so that I end book four of The Story of London with the beginning of its tale. So welcome then to chapter 122 of this story of London, No Man's Land. So let's get technical for a moment. The Black Death is the name we traditionally give to three variants of the same disease that all hit at about the same time. The name applies to a pandemic outbreak of bubonic, septicemic, and pneumonic plague that all hit simultaneously. In the subsequent centuries since, and especially in the modern era with a renewed fascination with pandemics, there have been a myriad of theories and studies of this disease. It's also led to a host of alternative theories, which have emerged claiming the disease that hit Europe in the 14th century was actually everything from an Ebola-type infection, something like Marburg, say, to it being anthrax and much more. However, based on all available evidence as it stands, the Black Death was an outbreak of variations of the plague, a disease that affects rodent species and is endemic to a number of regions in the world, including parts of Africa, Central Asia, and North and South America. The plague bacillus, the wonderfully named Yersinia pestis, lives in the bloodstreams of various rodent species such as rats, marmots, squirrels, and mice. The bacillus originally seemed to have been some utterly benign gut bacteria that remained in the creature's stomachs, but over time the bacillus evolved genetically to enter the animal's bloodstream. At this moment, it became lethal for its hosts. And just as fast as it had evolved to do that, it needed to evolve a way to move beyond its host. Luckily for it, nature is symbiotic. Without this symbiosis, the first rat or marmot to develop this variation would have died, and that would have just been that. Yet the symbiosis that allows foreign bacteria live happily in the guts of mammals, such as rats or humans, also conspire to work with other creatures. In this case, the fleas, which like to live on the skins and fur of rodents. This became the principal vector for the spreading of the bacillus. Whenever a flea, usually the species long associated with rodents, Xenophila sciophis, fed on an infected host, the plague bacillus would enter the flea. And there it would kill the flea, slowly. The bacillus would multiply inside the little flea's body, blocking its esophagus and making it chronically thirsty. The flea's tiny brain is driven by the compulsive need to bite continually to slake its thirst. When the rodent it had been feeding on dies, it will look for another host to drink from. But because its foregut is full of undigested infected blood, it will pass the plague bacillus into the bloodstream of whatever animal it tries to feed on next. The flea effectively becomes a teeny-tiny syringe, administering potentially little lethal doses of the disease to each new host. However, when the number of potential hosts diminished due to there being a plague outbreak, large number of fleas would end up living on the same animal because of this. A single rat could have hundreds of plague-infested fleas living on it. With so many fleas living on a single rat, unfortunately, that would probably die even quicker. And eventually, these rat fleas would be forced to go further afield to seek some kind of subsistence. These, however, are a particularly hardy type of insect, They can survive for up to 6 weeks without food, and for their size can travel quite a distance while looking for their next home, which perhaps goes a long way in explaining why the plague spread so far. This particular species of flea, for the record, does not especially like human blood, and will try and find anything else to bite. But in the absence of any other host, it will nobble down, and like a tiny syringe, the infection will enter the human, and the disease will take hold. Of the three versions of it in this pandemic, the most famous was bubonic plague. The first signs of the infection saw the victim become apathetic, quickly developing a high fever, with vomiting, extreme headaches, giddiness, intolerance to light, pains in the abdomen, back and limbs, sleeplessness, and acute diarrhea being not long in following on. Bubonic plague attacked the lymphatic system and produces boils, or buboes. Buboes, the name, originated from the Greek word for groin, bubon, and that explained where many of the boils erupted. Mostly, the bubos location depended on where the victim was bitten. Bites on the leg would result in bubos in the groin, which meant the victims would develop a pronounced limp as they tried to walk around without agitating this. Bites on the upper body would cause the bubos to either develop in the armpit, which caused the victims to raise their arms to relieve themselves of any pain from it touching it, or permanently cock their heads if the bubos developed on their neck. Regardless of where they developed, the bubos would actually vary in size. The smallest was about the size of an almond, while the largest could grow to the size of an orange. All were exceptionally painful and often noisy, being known to make strange gargling sounds. Most victims only ever developed one bubos, appearing between 2 to 6 days after their initial infection. If more did develop, they would normally be on the same chain of lymph glands. Contemporary records at the time also recorded then 3 other symptoms to follow. Bruise-like botches on the skin, probably caused by subcutaneous hemorrhages, which were nicknamed God's tokens. A severe delirium, which often led to episodes of manic shouting and laughing, or, if the victim was still able to stand and was not limping, dancing and walking aimlessly around in a trance until they collapsed, and then, finally, an all-pervasive stench that affected everything the body produced, from their breath, their sweat, their blood, to their urine, any pus, and their poop. If the buboes suppurated within a week, the victim usually recovered. If they did not, as happened in the majority of cases, the victim would die. Modern researchers found that untreated, bubonic plague has a mortality rate of about 60%. Pneumonic plague, or pulmonary plague, occurs when the bacillus is unable to get a hold on the human's lymphatic system. It doesn't give up and decides to develop in the lungs, leading to the most obvious symptom of this variation, the coughing up of blood. It is many times more infectious than bubonic plague, as every time the victim coughs, they will expel the plague as well as blood, causing airborne transmission. The victim will also be feverish, as with bubonic plague, and will experience very difficult and rapid breathing. Whereas with bubonic plague, there is some chance of survival if the buboes suppurate, the mortality rate for untreated pneumonic plague is around 95%, with victims usually dying between 1 and 3 days after their initial infection. Pneumonic plague tends to be more active in the colder months, while bubonic plague tended to be more dominant during the spring and the summer. Septicemic plague occurs when the bacillus couldn't get a hold of the lymphatic system and couldn't find a home in the lungs, and therefore decides just to infect the bloodstream. The bacillus will multiply profusely, causing the blood to become so quickly and totally infected that it becomes fatal remarkably fast. Although the rarest form of the main 3 types of plague, septicemic is perhaps the most frightening because it develops so quickly. I mean, the buboes don't even have time to form. Instead, the hands and the feet will turn black and harden. Stories of people going to bed seemingly well in the evening and being found dead in the bed the next morning sound like the work of the plague in its septicemic form. It is also the most lethal of the three variations. Untreated, the mortality rate of this version is 100%. If you get it, you're going to die. That simple, that brutal, that deadly. And so, this was the disease that had now arrived in Europe. But the thing was, England, and within it London, was one of the last places to get it. To get to January, it had to spread across the entire continent. Because of this, the residents of our city, they knew it was coming. By the January of 1348, it had started killing people in Avignon. The speed of its spread, terrifying rapid for those caught up in it, did provide sufficient time for the knowledge of this disease to spread out, and for the implications of this disease to be considered at the highest levels. Many Londoners must have known of the impending threat weeks, or perhaps months, before it arrived. England was a trading nation and one at war with France. A whole bunch of merchants in the city must have been aware by spring 1348, city after French city were falling before the scourge. If that wasn't enough, pilgrims to places like St. James de Compostela, or Rome, or other key religious centres, which had been affected early, must have also brought tales of woe and horror. We have to assume that knowledge of its approach was reasonably widespread in the city long before the disease made landfall, threatening to spread panic and terror. The earliest physical evidence that they knew it was coming appears in a papal correspondence in late spring 1348. On the 15th of May, King Edward III sent a team of papal diplomats to visit Pope Clement VI at Avignon to negotiate an extension of the existing truce in the war between England and France. And included in their ranks was a man called John de Repis, prior of the London Whitefriars. In response to the English delegation, the Pope wrote to King Philip of France to exhort him to likewise send envoys to Avignon, stating that it was important to carry on with the negotiations for the truce, quote, unless hindered by the epidemic, unquote. So people were talking about it like they knew it was happening. As early as July 1348, up in York, the Archbishop of the city wrote, quote, there can be no one who does not know, since it is now public knowledge, how a great mortality, pestilence, and infection of the air are now threatening various parts of the world, and especially England, unquote. And while there is much in Europe that deserves our attention, as the plague made its way slowly up Italy, across France and Germany, devastating the Iberian Peninsula, our story is the story of London, and I make no apologies for a bias towards the city story. The paradox about the plague is that while the Italians especially contained the most vivid writers and accounts of the Black Death, and Italy, Spain, Germany and France gave us many details about the outbreak that have travelled to history far more readily, for example the flagellates or the blaming of Jews and the pogroms that followed, England, which didn't have these things, did have the most precise historical records about the pandemic. In the parish records of this country, we alone have a most unique account of the scale of this terrible disease and what it did to the population. Oddly enough, it was not called the Black Death at the time. That title, supposedly thought to refer to the buboes, in fact did not appear until 1555, when a Swedish chronicle employed the term. And when they did, it was then ignored. Later, around about the 17th century, it appeared in a Danish account about the outbreak. And here in Britain, we only started to use the term around about the 1670s, when we used Black Death to distinguish it from the Great Plague of 1665. Even then, the term the Black Death does not appear to have gained widespread use to refer to the pandemic of the 1340s until about the 19th century. The phrase Black Death is actually usually taken to be a mistranslation, either into English or Swedish, of the Latin terms atra mors or pestis atra. The word atra can mean black, but also terrible or dreadful, so it could easily have been called the terrible death. At the time the outbreak happened, well, in Europe it was known as the Great Pestilence, the mortality, the pestilence time, the plague of Florence, or simply the plague. The Arabs, and the Middle East was hit just as hard as Europe, used more evocative titles. The year of annihilation, the great destruction. Another surprising factor going into this story was that epidemics and plagues using that name were not unknown to London. Far from it. And indeed, the terms plague or pestilence were in common usage in this time. One of the earliest medieval records of a Londoner dying of something called plague is the passing of Bishop Fulk Bassett back in 1259. We mentioned this back in chapter 95 of the podcast, as records at the time said, quote, an awful and intolerable pestilence attacked the people, especially those of the lower orders, and spread death amongst them in the most lamentable degree. In the city of London, 15,000 of the poor had already perished, unquote. So large-scale epidemics in 14th century London were known before the arrival of the Black Death. And like that one, they were occasionally of significant dimension. We have records of a, quote, great pestilence, unquote, amongst the survivors of the famine of 1315 and 1316, while one other chronicler of the time recorded how a plague in 1340 caused, quote, men to bark like dogs, unquote, with the pain they were feeling. It's perhaps this outbreak, or another one that wasn't actually recorded, that led to a proclamation being read out in London on the 10th of August in 1343, and that as part of measures introduced to keep the king's peace, quote, all men of the mysteries, as well as victuallers, journeymen, labourers and servants, shall work as they used to do before the pestilence, under pain of imprisonment or fine, unquote. The early 1340s pestilence left no trace within the wealthier group of citizens of London who tended to make wills. It could, however, that the rich did not suffer from it as much as the poor. And it is noteworthy that whatever this plague was, it did elicit a response from the city authorities. So the London of the 1340s was no stranger to epidemics, and epidemics that could kill many people. It's just that nothing that had happened before could have prepared the residents of London for what was just about to hit it. As the summer of 1348 wore on, the warnings about the great contagion raging on the continent became more explicit. On the 17th of August, 1348, the Bishop of Bath and Wells sent word to his parishioners that a terrible disease had arrived in a neighbouring kingdom and urged that, quote, unless we pray devoutly and incessantly, a similar pestilence will stretch its poisonous branches into this realm and strike down and consume its inhabitants, unquote. In the surprisingly wet days of that summer, and the weather was miserable that year apparently, the good and faithful of London were extolled to prayer to beg God to see off the oncoming slaughter. We forget that Londoners then had much in common with Londoners now, but also some really powerful differences. They were collectively a people of faith and strong belief. Their prayers were devoutly made, sermons warned, and it's not beyond reason to assume that some Londoners began to build up their spiritual good graces to earn God's favour with what was to come. We know that's exactly what the king was doing at this time. As well as his usual occupations as being concerned with diplomacy about his war in France and trying to run the state, Edward III decided to try and make moves that would put him in favour with the Almighty. The Chapel of St. Stephen in Westminster Palace had been under incredibly long renovations for a number of years, and it wasn't even close to being finished. However, on the 6th of August 1348, Edward confirmed the establishment of a college comprising of a dean and 12 canons to be based there, and then granted them his, quote, great inn, unquote, in Lombard Street in the city at the same time. The king cemented this arrangement on the 20th of August through a grant for life to a number of his senior servants. The clerk of the great wardrobe, Thomas Cross, received the deanery, and three of his servants, John de Chesterfield, John de Maidstone, and his chamberlain, John de Buckingham, received prebendary positions. On its own, this may have just seemed like he was just setting up a chapel, but he did this on the very same day he recorded his intention to enhance considerably the small college of 8 canons up at Windsor Castle. It feels like an offering, a gesture to show his piety in the hope that God will bless him in the face of the plague to come. It was, alas, however, too small a gesture, and the disease was to strike his family hard. His daughter, Princess Joan, was due to marry a Spanish prince, Pedro, Infant of Castilla. On their route to Spain, Joan and her entourage departed Portsmouth in early August. but she perished of the plague on the 2nd of September. King Edward admitted he was hit by, quote, the sting of this bitter grief, unquote. Nor was this the full sum of Edward's personal woes. On the 5th of September, at a lavish and full regal funeral, Edward's 3-month-old son, William of Windsor, was laid to rest in Westminster Abbey. The infant's body had been brought from Brentford, probably having been borne there by boat from Windsor, to London, accompanied by 50 paupers carrying torches, for which they were paid 1 shilling each, and was laid out in the Abbey Church. Yet, even with all of this, the City of London, right on the eve of destruction, mostly just carried on as it always had. Goods were bought and sold. Property was purchased. Taxes were raised and grumbled about. People broke the law and got away with it. And occasionally, people broke the law and got caught for it and punished for it. London was still London. And I mean, there was a war on. It was probably the pressures of the war that saw in 1348, over at the Tower of London, a new Watergate, the Cradle Tower, began to be constructed to permit direct royal access from the river into the fortress. This tower had been started early in 1348, and the building was continued throughout the plague's outbreak. Its name may have been derived from the presence of a drawbridge, lowered outward to provide a landing stage for the royal barge and then raised to seal the outer entrance to the Watergate. The Tower of London was becoming much more important on the eve of the plague. It was acting as a royal palace, a storehouse, a site for the royal mint, where the royal jewels were kept, and also as a royal prison. And it's there we see a small slice of life that shows how Londoners were just carrying on before the plague arrived in 1348. There was this man called Nicholas de Lucca. He was under the employment of Percival de Portico, the master of the king's money in the Tower of London. De Portico discovered something didn't quite match out in the Tower's accounts, and he suspected de Lucca of fraud, and the unfortunate man found himself jailed in the place where he was normally employed. In time, however, de Lucca was able to account for the differences, and he was released. At the same time, and across London, one of my favourite criminals of this era appears in the records. William Tallentire was a clerk who'd been sent to Newgate Prison for a most cunning bit of forgery. Tallentire had been discovered with a fake royal charter. This forgery made much more authentic because Tallentire had attached the king's seal to it, quote, ingeniously abstracted from certain of the king's letters patent, unquote, and then fastened that charter to pass it off like he had some royal edict. Elaborate con men in London have long been friends. And I mean, away from the fear of plague, the war with France was London's main source of concern. And on the 11th of September that year, there were probably cheers when the city sheriffs announced that a truce had been concluded with France for the term of 6 weeks. However, negotiations for longer-term peace were still by no means complete, so simultaneously, King Edward was augmenting his forces in case of failure. On October the 1st, he issued a writ to the sheriffs of London, telling them to unload all the merchant ships at the dock and send them to join a fleet he was gathering in the Channel, just in case. But by then, the plague had arrived in England. Various chronicles at the time, and many historians have since postulated that the plague arrived in England between late June and late September 1348, and I personally favour the latter part of this time frame. The earliest inklings of the pandemic to come we find on September 28th. Ralph Stanford, the Bishop of London, received a letter carrying the King's orders of what they should be doing here on the very cusp of the pandemic. Quote, it is now to be feared that the kingdom is to be oppressed by the pestilences and wretched mortalities which have flared up in other regions, unquote. The language there clearly indicates that on the 28th of September, it's clear the disease had not yet got a proper foothold in England. By way of rationalising the plague, the instructions said that God used such devices to, quote, terrify and torment men and so drive them out of their sins, unquote. And the representatives of the Archbishop of Canterbury exhorted the bishop to organise sermons at suitable times and processions every Wednesday and Friday to help reinforce this point and to pacify God by showing how holy everyone was. The citizens who partook in these processions were to be offered indulgences, granting them a reduction of their time in purgatory. and the bishop was to personally ensure these measures were set in place throughout the city and Diocese of London, and to communicate to his fellow bishops round about early January about what actions he'd taken. Bishop Ralph Stratford received these instructions by October the 5th, 1348, and communicated them to the people, quote, during procession and sermon in the cathedral, unquote. So right now, on the very cusp of the plague, the sounds of twice-weekly processions and the rings of bells filled London streets out of the fear of it. We can be sure that by early October, all of London was aware that death was threatening and that their city now lay in its path. Quite possibly the first infected carriers already entered the city and the inexorable invisible spread had begun. A writer at the time, a man called Geoffrey Le Baker, maintained that the pestilence entered London on the 29th of September 1348. A later written annal from Bermondsey Abbey in Southwark repeats this date, but that may have been based on Le Baker's work. And the problem with Le Baker saying that the disease hit London on the 29th of September is that it seems a bit too early given the evidence that we have of what else was going on. Like, the number of last will and testaments that rich Londoners made at this time and recorded in the hustings was only 6 in October 1348. And the number of letters to the Pope for people to choose their confessors was about standard. It does not paint a picture of fear or panic. I mean, during October 1348, the war with France and negotiations over prisoners captured during the King's Scottish campaigns, especially young King David II, and other domestic issues seem to have taken up more of Edward's energies than any preparation for the plague. Certainly, his business relating to London reveals no specific evidence of disaster ongoing. He remained in Westminster throughout most of October, and on the 8th, he issued a writ to the sheriffs of London for a proclamation to be made, quote, for such men-at-arms, hobblers, archers and others, as are willing to serve the king abroad, to be at Sandwich on Sunday before the feast of Saints Simon and Jude, unquote. 2 days later, Edward's issuing safe conduct until summer of the next year for Joan, the wife of King David II of Scotland, and for her to come to the Tower of London to keep her husband company. And on the 12th of October, he issued protection to the Prior of Bermondsey. Remember, that's a Coulniac house, and the Coulniacs were seen as a French order, and so they needed the king's protection to keep operating in England during the war. We also see that at this time, there was an investigation into the theft of £188 worth of jewels and other items from the Tower of London, sometime between their deposition in 1347 and the 25th of October 1348. And that led the king to issue a formal pardon to the keeper of the king's treasurer and a couple of others for not managing the royal assets properly. All these issues and correspondence focusing on current events and normal royal responsibilities do not seem to match with an image of a city being racked by disease and death. And to reinforce this point more, as October drew to a close, changes to London's civic administration came about as they always did. The term of Mayor Thomas Legg came to an end, and he was replaced by a man called John Lufkin. Lufkin was a stalwart of London's politics. He was a fishmonger and had risen in the ranks of that most argumentative of crafts. But he'd been elected a warden of London Bridge and then sheriff of the city all the way back in 1342. He'd become designated an alderman in 1347. He'd been twice elected a member of parliament back in 44 and 46. And as such, having followed this usual progression of power, he was duly elected mayor of London in 1348. His term was to last for the duration of the outbreak of the plague, and he was to survive it and be mayor a few more times in the future. Lufkin was not the only Londoner gaining high office at the end of October. The king also selected a man called John de Offord, then the Chancellor of England and above all a prebend of St Paul's Cathedral, as his preferred candidate to be Archbishop of Canterbury. The Pope approved the decision, despite the fact that the monks in Canterbury had wanted another canon based in London, Thomas Brandwardine, to become Archbishop instead. So, yeah, it doesn't look like the disease entered London on the 29th of September. So when did it? Well, in late October, in a chamber near the heart of the Palace of Westminster, the new Archbishop of Canterbury's commissary clerk, a man called Robert of Avesbury, was no doubt hard at work. Avesbury was probably London's most credible eyewitness chronicler to the unfolding disaster, and it is from his account that we are provided with the date of All Saints' Day, the 1st of November 1348, as the beginning of the visible signs of the pestilence in the city, as it took root, and as it, quote, daily deprived many of life, unquote. It was November. The weather was by all accounts cold and wet, the ideal conditions for the contagious pulmonary version of the plague. It is likely then that the first wave that hit the city, the first version of the Black Death in London, had less in common with the oldie images of rustic medieval peasants with buboes, but more in common with our most recent pandemic of COVID, of a outbreak heralded by a terrifying cough. The arrival of the plague in November 1348 is witnessed via small details. The making of wills suggests a significant increase at the very end of October. Of the six wills drawn up that month, four were dated in the last 5 days. Within 3 weeks, on the 14th of November, a papal instruction was issued to the clergy and the people of both sexes of London to permit them to choose whatever confessors they wanted to give plenary remission at their hour of death. This suggested very quickly that the need for confessors was rapidly overwhelming the existing legion of priests in London, and that the plague was starting to hit London really hard. The king decided to act. A new long-term peace treaty with the French had been signed over in Calais, and King Edward had sailed to Calais to witness it on October the 29th. He saw for himself what lay in store for his kingdom and his capital there in France, and having witnessed the appalling impact, he headed back from France on the 17th of November. The scale of the threat of his kingdom was now much more clear, and he decided to take decisive action. On the 20th of November, he issued a summons to Parliament, to all the archbishops, 21 principal bishops, 28 abbots of the larger monastic houses, 3 priors, and more to discuss, quote, various urgent business and the state of the realm of England, unquote. The summons to the Bishop of London, in particular, warned them that the Dean and Chapter of St. Paul's and the archdeacons and clergy of his diocese should also turn up. On the same day, the king issued orders for the sheriffs of Cornwall, Somerset, Devon, Dorset, Southampton, Essex, Surrey, Sussex, Norfolk, Suffolk, Lincoln, Kent and London to not attempt to leave the country. 3 days later, when he was in Westminster, he issued orders effectively closing the ports of Dover, Southampton, Newcastle, Lynn, Great Yarmouth, loads of ports, including London, forbidding crossing from London of any earl, baron, knight, squire, or man-at-arms as well. He summoned an emergency parliament, but that was never to meet, overwhelmed by circumstances. The complete lockdown of England, however, was literally too little and too late. One man who might have been expected to attend that parliament that was never held was Alan Ferthing, 6-time Member of Parliament for the Borough of Southwark. His name is last mentioned in the connection with that parliament in 1348, but it seems certain that he perished in the epidemic. By chance, many years later in 1832, workmen digging through a sewer on the site of the medieval church of St. Margaret in Southwark found his marble grave slab. It's been relaid in Southwark Cathedral and is probably the only remaining funerary monument in London made at the time of the plague. The plague that was now gripping London. The number of hustings wills increased to 10 in the month of November and included several city worthies. Sir John de Pulteney, 4 times mayor, willed on the 14th of November the establishment of a chantry in St. Paul's Cathedral and made arrangements for the sale of his great mansion, Cold Harbour, for the price of £1,000. John the Killisye, a goldsmith from the parish of St. Mary Aldermary, by his will dated on the 11th of November, instructed his wife to distribute every month for her lifetime 17 silver pennies, 1 each to poor men and 2 pence to a poor woman. John de Hicken, a pepperer and rector of the Church of St. Antoine since at least 1345, wrote on his will on the 28th of November that a fraternity called the Wardens of the House of St. Anne should celebrate anniversaries for his soul. It's difficult to imagine what Londoners were facing during those first few weeks of the plague. The disease and winter arrived in the city together, in a year already renowned for its storms and constant rains. A monk in Westminster during the outbreak, called John of Reading, wrote that rain had covered the south and west of England, quote, from midsummer to Christmas, scarcely stopping by day or by night, unquote. Short, grim days and long, terrifying dark nights set the scene for the unfolding horror. The knowledge that the plague was at hand would have turned general fear into outright terror. Every cough or twinge of pain was a potential sign of death. Reports would have spread through the city of the first mortalities, perhaps down by the waterfront or near the city's gates. People could have tried to move to less infected quarters, but that was pointless. Death stalked the entire city. London's experiences were not much different than other European cities during this year, so we can imagine household after household ripped apart by the appearance of the symptoms on a strong husband, a caring wife, a loving mother, a beloved child. Few who got the disease had any chance of survival. The idea that what was hitting London was a pneumonic plague is reinforced by the words of several writers. Geoffrey Le Baker noted that very few developed buboes. The rapidity of the disease meant the fate of the victim was decided in 5 days or less, most commonly three, a time frame confirmed by Robert of Aylesbury and the other London eyewitness monk, John of Reading, which suggests 3 days. It was pulmonary plague. With its 95% mortality rate, this version of the plague would have been brutal. There were cases of bubonic plague happening, but the speed of the deaths of victims suggests it was the airborne version of the disease that was mostly gripping the city during the winter of 1348. It's also noted that the disease seemed to chiefly overwhelm the young and the strong. And later studies showed that plague appeared to target men over women, and various strains seemed to target differing demographics, with at least one future outbreak specifically targeting children. Most horrible of all, according to Le Baker, quote, hardly anyone dared to have anything to do with the sick, unquote. The terror of developing a nasty, painful and bloody cough and the host of other symptoms, compounded by the fact that those nearest and dearest to you avoided you for fear of the contagion, is something no one with any empathy would ever like to contemplate. What could those Londoners who were not infected and were wandering the streets of the city do in the face of this? We have a glimpse of advice given to them. A medieval parchment found tucked into a wall of a rectory in Dorset in the middle of the 19th century provides a glimpse of the advice Londoners were given during the plague. And it was a writing down of a proclamation that had been given out at the preaching cross in St. Paul's Cathedral. And it says, quote, be it known to all Christian men and women that our Holy Father the Pope has true knowledge by revelation what medicine is for the sickness that reigneth over the people. First say in the worship of God, Our Lady and St. Martin, three Paternosters, three Aves, and one Credo. And on the morrow, immediately after, hear you the Mass of St. Martin, and the Mass while you shall say the Psalter of Our Lady, and give one offering to St. Martin, whether that ye will, and promise to fast once a year in bread and water while you live, or else get someone else to do it for you. And he that believeth not of this stands in sentence of the Holy Church, for it has been preached at Paul's cross, unquote. And so armed with this spiritual armour, Londoners were being told they could gain a measure of protection. And yet, not surprising to us, the hacking, blood-splattered coughing continued, and within the walls the dead began to mount up. Dozens died, then hundreds, then thousands. The plague's impact on the city in December 1348 was quite clear from the 27 hustings wills prepared during this time, four written on a single day alone, the 13th of December. This represents a stunning increase, nearly three times the rate of November, and basically was the equivalent of 1 year's worth of wills in total in 1 month. In the Bishop of London's manor up in Stepney in December 1348, four members of one family, a mother, daughter and two sons, had died And in a court held at the following January, it was recorded that 9 entire tenements were reported vacant owing to the deaths of their tenants. To the south of the city, sudden clerical vacancies were filled by the Bishop Ebrington in the Church of St. Mary Magdalene, Southwark and Wandsworth in January, and in February needed to be filled in Clapham, Camberwell and St. George the Martyr, Southwark, all less than 5 miles from the city. Due to the nature of records, it's usually only the richer men and women of London whose stories we hear about. Henry Iddlesworth, Canon of St. Paul's and Archdeacon of Middlesex, made arrangements to leave his house in Wood Street and shops in the parish of St. John Zachary towards the founding of a perpetual chantry in St. Paul's Cathedral. Edmund de Hemenhale, a former Sheriff of London and wealthy Merthyr, arranged for 2 executors to receive his estate in Cheapside during the minority of his sons, John and Thomas, with a house in Lothbury being set aside for the eldest. Edmund's family was still young. Thomas was only 5, and he had a daughter called Margaret, who was 1. Edmund was probably buried in St. Martin-le-Grand, since his wife established a chantry for them both when she died in 1361. Geoffrey Penthog, a water-bearer, willed on the 30th of December to be buried in the church of St. Bartholf, Aldgate. He left his wife, Joanna, a house and garden in the Portsoken Ward, and his son, John, a garden up in East Smithfield. He was dead within 10 days, as Joanna's will, written on the 9th of January, requested burial near her husband. These wealthier citizens were able to plan, afford and implement such arrangements and actually arrange for their places of burial. This, however, did not apply to the vast majority of London's population. Being poor, they might normally expect a modest plot in one of the many small external cemeteries attached to the parish churches within the city walls. But with mortality spiralling, it became clear to the Bishop of London, Ralph Stratford, that these, fairly numerous though they were, cemeteries might not suffice for this disaster. At some point between the outbreak of the plague and the end of December, Stratford had arranged for a new cemetery to be established on the city's outskirts. The Chronicle of Geoffrey Le Baker described how the bishop had bought a croft called by the Londoners No Man's Lond. This field lay south of another field called White Wellback, between modern St. John Street and Goswell Road, and that was apparently the site of executions during this early 14th century. No Man's Lond measured some 3 acres, according to the 16th century historian John Stowe, and eventually acquired the name of Pardon Churchyard. By the early 15th century, they earned the name of Dead Man's Croft. This burial ground is known to lie between what is now Great Sutton Street to the north and Clerkenwell Road to the south. The principal route to it out of the city was through Aldersgate, up past St. Bartholomew's Priory and along what is now Goswell Road. The dead could also be taken there via Newgate and Smithfield and thence up St. John Street. It's not clear when this new cemetery first began to take burials, but an argument could be made that despite its considerable size, it was approaching capacity before the end of the year. The carts removing the dead from the city must have been numerous indeed. As we will see, a later emergency cemetery of comparable size at East Smithfield was able to easily contain 2,500 burials, a figure which could be achieved at a rate of some 40 burials each day in November and December. And such rates of death match well the description of the beginning of the plague by Robert of Avesbury, who noted that, quote, on the same day, 20, 40 or 60 bodies, and on many occasions many more, might be committed for burial together in the same pit, unquote. Placing such figures in context, if you assume London had a population of about 60,000, in a normal year you might expect 6 burials or less a day across a city of that size. They're up to 60, and it could be more. And this was only the beginning. Things were going to get worse. Strangely enough, the King and his treasurer both remained in London for much of December. They were in the Royal Chamber in the Tower of London on the 14th of December, when the Bishop-elect of Canterbury took the oath of fealty, and the King was in Westminster from before the 28th of December through to January the following year. He was therefore well placed to witness the unfolding catastrophe. The King did leave London to celebrate the Epiphany on January the 6th, so he witnessed the horror of December 1348. It may have been around this time that accusations of poisoning the water supply of the city were made. Fear of well poisoning by foreigners and Jews had already gripped many places in Europe and contributed to terrible massacres of Jewish people. England, of course, had no permanent Jewish community at this time, but it seems probable that other scapegoats were being targeted. Nobody liked the French. The conduit, the principal pipe water supply to Cheapside, was under the administration of two men at the time, Robert Fundor and William de St. Albans. They raised money from various methods to upkeep its maintenance, and in their accounts covering the two-year period around 1348, they showed that at one specific time the hefty sum of 32 shillings and two pence was spent, quote, examining the conduit when it was slandered for poison by command of the mayor, unquote. But they would have found no poison, as the contagion was not coming from there. But the fear was great. The plague fully had a grip upon London as the cold winter of 1348 ended and 1349 began, and the horror was only just starting. And in the days to come, the end of the era of the Winter Kings came to its brutal and sudden conclusion. For the last few kings of England, from Henry III to Edward I through Edward II and Edward III, London had been a fractious place, filled with its own passions and troubled relationships with its kings. But as the new year dawned in 1349, and the suffering of the city was witnessed personally by Edward III, possibly seeing the carts of dead bodies being taken out to the new cemetery of No Man's Land, none of these things seemed important anymore. In 1348, the London that had been died, and the new London would arrive. That's if it somehow survived the contagion that currently gripped the city. And we'll cover that next episode. Book 5 of The Story of London, the 123rd chapter of this podcast, will be released next week as we conclude the story of the coming of the Black Death. Hope you enjoyed this one, and I hope you'll carry on with this era moving forward. To those who are just joining us, thank you. The Story of London is a weekly podcast that relies on no adverts or any kind of external funding. We take any contributions given to us by our listeners, either in one-off donations or by subscribing to our Buy Me a Coffee page. These funds help just cover the costs of hosting the website and additional costs for licenses for music and things like that. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again next week.